Chapter 21. Into the Dragon's Lair. The stairs were unlit, as was the room into which we descended. But Sidney Grice soon had three oil lamps lit, and the more my eyes became accustomed to their glare, the more dingy our surroundings looked. True, it was decorated, as my guardian had predicted, in supposedly erotic murals, but they were clumsily drawn and peeling in the damp that infests all London cellars. The four sofas were upholstered in balding velvet, with the grease marks of 1,000 heads on their backs and arms, and peppered with countless burns. Each sofa had a long, low table in front of it, the red paint marked and blistered by the heat of innumerable pipes. The furniture stood on a large square rug, red, of course, which looked fairly new but could not disguise the hardness of the stone floor beneath it. Mr. G. pulled back another drape in the far left-hand corner to reveal a plain plank door, locked with the key removed. He pressed his ear to the woodwork and rapped once with his knuckles. "What are we looking for?" I asked, hoping he would not say something as vague as clues. My guardian glanced at the ceiling, stained with smoke and dotted with hundreds of ochre splots that were probably meant to be suns.
"Oh, for goodness sake!"
He reached into his inner pocket.
"Do I have to write you a list?"
"No," I replied, taken aback by his sharpness, but apparently he felt he did, for he was scribbling away industriously in his notebook and cringing at the desecration as he tore out another page.
"Take this."
He pressed the folded paper into my hands.
"And go and read it under that oil lamp."
He pointed to the one at the foot of the stairs, and I was about to insist that I could read it just as well where I was when I felt his toe tap mine. "Very well." I went over and unfolded his missive.
1. Do not say anything. 2. When I say the word fascinating, you are to re-enter the reception area as quietly as your ungainly construction permits, remembering, as you should have observed during our descent, that the 9th tread on your ascent crepitates, so as to present yourself unexpectedly to Mr. Thomas David Jones. 3. Pay particular attention to what he is doing. He will be doing something. The Welsh are always doing something. 4. Exercise one of your few skills by devising a convincing untruth for your unexpected appearance.
Mr. G. dropped onto his haunches and tipped his head like a blackbird listening for worms.
"This is not fascinating,"
he said. I clamped my jaw tight just in time to choke back my instinctive reply and set my foot upon the first step. The stairwell was so narrow that my dresses rustled noisily against the wall.
"The police will not be intrigued by what I have found,"
my guardian declaimed, never quite able to bring himself to tell a lie. I was on the third step as he boomed out,
"For I shall not, having no motive to do so, grant them such information."
Another step, holding my skirts in as best I could.
"I have not seen the like of this unenchanting thing in 19 years,
came after me, by which time I had reached step 6 of about 14. "Blimmit," I cursed quietly as my hem snagged on a splinter.
"Language,"
my godfather responded automatically, but it was all I could do to restrain my tongue as the lining ripped when I pulled it free. It was a light blue dress and not new, but it had given me good service and had a useful secret pocket, just large enough for my spare cigarette case.
"My word, this is not markedly different from the last one I came across."
Mr. G. struggled to continue as the stair squealed under me.
"Sorry,"
I hissed. I had thought I was on the 8th step.
"Oh, just get a move on,"
he rapped, and I galloped up the remaining 5 steps like a herd of mollies in full stampede, almost wrenching the screen off its runners as I stumbled through the opening at the top. Thomas Jones was intent upon his inkwell as I burst into view.
"What are you doing?"
he demanded.
"What are you doing?"
I demanded.
"You were supposed to be in that chair."
He snapped the lid back down.
"Nobody tells me what to do in my own establishment."
His face was flushed and looking less oriental now.
Mr. Grice does, I assured him.
Footsteps sounded on the stairs and Jones hastened back to his chair.
You won't say anything, he pleaded,
now a naughty child trying to do a deal with Nanny.
I always say something, I told him.
Oh, be a sport.
Jones hitched up his robes, showing off a rather flashy pair of embroidered pink slippers that I would not have minded for myself. He was bent over his desk, I announced as my guardian appeared.
Have you even heard of the word circumspect, Miss Middleton?
Mr. G took a constitutional round me, then swayed and dropped to the floor. He could not have tripped, and it was not a faint. People who swoon crumble at the knees, but my godfather crashed like a statue being toppled from its plinth onto his shoulder. His eyes were still open. Was he having some kind of fit? I was about to kneel and check when he rolled onto his back, sat up, and sprang acrobatically to his feet.
Indeed, he told himself,
scooped out his gloves in his left hand, whipped up his hat with his right, and went to the exit, apparently none the worse for his experience.
I think it comes from the Latin, circum and specere, I told his back, determined not to be as nonplussed as I felt.
I am elated to find evidence of you thinking at all.
Sidney Grice opened the door in a disconcertingly normal manner. Oh, I said lamely, as he marched straight out.
Goodbye, Mr. Jones.
My godfather was 5 yards away by the time I got outside.
Wait for me, Mr. Grice,
I called after him. There was a message on the hall table when we got back to 125 Gower Street. A letter with the familiar blue 8-pointed Brunswick Star crest on the envelope.
You open it.
My guardian was preoccupied in rearranging his canes. A body had been found which might be of interest. I read out, and Sidney Grice jabbed his finger at the missive.
Why was it not in my tray?
He demanded of Molly, and she chewed her lower lip.
I don't not think a body would fit in there, sir,
she decided.
Oh!
Molly clutched her stomach.
Whatever is the matter?
I asked. Her face was pale and clammy.
Oh, miss!
She moaned, seeming to think that was sufficient explanation.
Are you ill?
Of course she is ill.
Mr. G opened another letter.
If a servant is healthy, he or she, or in this wretched creature's case, it, is not working hard enough.
I think it might be the poison I drank.
Molly staggered towards me, but mercifully did not collapse in my arms.
To kill the mouse a bit.
You took mouse poison?
Only all of it.
Molly flopped her arms weakly. Her employer headed towards his study.
But where did you get it?
I considered whether to summon a cab or try to get her up the road to the hospital by foot.
From that cupboard what Mr. Grice told me never to touch what got accidentally unlocked.
Oh, Molly, I cried. He keeps acids and all sorts of things in there.
Not all sorts.
Molly flapped a hand weakly.
He don't not keep no chocolates or beer, 'cause I've looked.
But what did you take?
There were beads of sweat on her downy upper lip.
Look at the lumpen wench's tongue,
came out from the study.
This.
Molly delved in her apron pocket and handed me a brown bottle. Vermilion, I read from the label.
Verminions is rats and mice and liberals,
she explained, leaning heavily on the hall table.
Mr. Grice told me that.
Die, I continued.
I'm trying,
she retorted irritably. It is a stain, I explained, and saw too late that her tongue was bright red.
Oh, bless!
Molly clamped her paws together.
Mrs. Mouse will look ever so pretty now.
You have not swallowed a mouse, I assured her wearily.
Oh, no!
Molly plonked her fists on her substantial hips.
Well, how come I've stained her red, then?
Tea!
Sidney Grice barked. And she scurried off, her logic irrefutable.